Chapter 6. Less. Few would dispute we become a culture of overeaters. From around 1850 to 1960, the American Mean Body Mass Index, a measurement of fat based on height, was between 20 and 22. That's about 160 pounds for a 6-foot-tall person. Today, the average BMI is 29. That 6-foot-tall person now weighs 214 pounds. 70% of the U.S. population is considered overweight. 1 in 3 are obese. There's no doubt we're eating more than we did in the past. Rates of breathing are much more difficult to gauge because there are fewer studies and the results are inconsistent. Nonetheless, a review of the available research offers a troubling picture. What's considered medically normal today is anywhere between a dozen and 20 breaths a minute, with an average intake of about 0.5 liter per breath. For those on the high end of the respiratory rates, that's about twice as much as it was. One thing that every medical or freelance pulmonaut I've talked to in the past several years has told me is that just as we become a culture of overeaters, we've also become a culture of overbreathers. Most of us breathe too much, and up to a quarter of us suffer from serious chronic overbreathing. The fix is easy. Breathe less. But that's harder than it sounds. We become conditioned to breathe too much just as we become conditioned to eat too much. With some effort and training, however, breathing less can become an unconscious habit. Indian yogis train themselves to decrease the amount of air they take at rest, not increase it. Tibetan Buddhists prescribe step-by-step instructions to reduce and calm breathing for aspiring monks. Chinese doctors 2,000 years ago advised 13,500 breaths per day, which works out to about 9.5 breaths per minute. They likely breathed less in those fewer breaths. In Japan, legend has it the samurai would test a soldier's readiness by placing a feather beneath his nostrils while he inhaled and exhaled. If the feather moved, the soldier would be dismissed. To be clear, breathing less is not the same as breathing slowly. Average adult lungs can hold about 4 to 6 liters, which means that if we practice slow breathing at 5.5 breaths per minute, we could still be taking in twice the air we need. The key to optimum breathing and all the health, endurance, and longevity benefits that come with it is to practice fewer inhales and exhales in a smaller volume. To breathe, but to breathe less. With only 4 days left in the Stanford experiment, I was reaping the benefits of slowing my respiratory rate. My blood pressure kept dropping, my heart rate variability kept rising, and I had more energy than I knew what to do with. All the while, Olson kept prodding me to reduce my breathing rate even further. He harped on about the wonders of breathing way less than anyone normally should, the respiratory equivalent of fasting. Now, starving yourself of air can be bad if it becomes a regular thing. Ordinarily, we should breathe as closely in line with our needs as we can, but occasionally willing the body to breathe way less has some potent benefits just as fasting does. Sometimes, Olson told me, it can lead to euphoria. It was a better feeling than when I got married, better than when my first child was born, he says. It's morning, and we're driving past the ragged waves along Highway 1. I'm at the wheel, and Olson is beside me on the passenger seat. He's smiling broadly, reliving the moment 5 years ago when he saw God. I ran for an hour or so, 6 miles, I think, and I came home and sat in my living room chair. His voice here is quivering a little. He's almost laughing. And I had this dull headache, that good headache, and I felt the most intense peace and unity in the world. Everything. Our destination today is Golden Gate Park, which offers miles of uninterrupted jogging tracks beneath canopies of blue gum eucalyptus. Because the tracks are dirt, we won't split our heads open and die if we suddenly go unconscious. This is a rare but real side effect of this breathing way less thing we'll be attempting. Olson swears by this approach. He and his clients have reported profound improvements in endurance and well-being after just a few weeks. However, I've heard from many others it could be miserable and might induce vicious headaches, not those good ones. It wasn't for dabblers. I turn the car from the freeway and park beside the lot of the Golden Gate Casting Club. A herd of buffalo behind a chain-link fence stare with bored eyes as Olsen and I slip off our jackets, take a few last swigs of water, lock the car, and hit the ground running. To be clear, I hate jogging. Unlike other physical activities like surfing or swimming, whenever I jog, I'm fully conscious of the misery and boredom of every second. I've never reached that spaced-out runner's high, even though, years back, I put in 4-mile runs every other day. The benefits of jogging were obvious. I always felt great afterwards. But doing it was a grind. Olsen wanted to change my mind. He's been jogging for decades and has trained dozens of runners. The key is to find a rhythm that works for you, he tells me as we beeline into the bramble. You should challenge yourself, but at the same time, don't overdo it. The trail splits off, and we follow the path less traveled. The sun shines through the skyscraper trees, and there's musty spearmint in the air. I listen to the sound of footfalls crunching on crispy leaves. It's nice. What I want you to do is, as you warm up, start extending your exhales, Olsen tells me. Each breath we draw in should take about 3 seconds, and each breath out should take about 4. We'll continue the same short inhale, longer exhale pattern, but extend those exhales to 5, 6, or 7 counts as we run further. These slower, longer exhales, of course, mean higher carbon dioxide levels. With that bonus CO2, we can gain a higher aerobic endurance. Training the body to breathe less actually increases the amount of oxygen we can consume, which can not only boost stamina, but also help us live longer and healthier lives. The godfather of this less-is-more approach was a Polmanot born in 1923 on a grubby farm outside of Kiev in what is now Ukraine. His name was Konstantin Buteyko, and he spent his youth examining the world around him. Anything, really. Plants, insects, toys, and cars. He came to view the world as a mechanism, and everything within it as a collection of parts locking together to form a greater whole. By the time he was a teenager, Buteyko had developed into a brilliant mechanic and would later spend 4 years on the front lines of World War II fixing cars, tanks, and artillery. When the war ended, I decided to start researching the most complex machine, the man, Buteyko would write. I thought, if I learned him, I'd be able to diagnose his diseases as easily as I had diagnosed machine disorders. Buteyko went on to attend the first Moscow Institute of Medicine, the most prestigious medical school in the Soviet Union. He graduated cum laude. During his residency rounds, he noticed the patients in the worst health all seemed to breathe far too much. The more they breathed, the worse off they were, especially those with hypertension. Buteyko himself had suffered from severe high blood pressure, along with the headaches and heart pain that came with it. He'd been put on prescription drugs to no effect. When he was 29, his systolic blood pressure had shot up to 212, a dangerously high number. Doctors gave him a year to live. One can avoid cancer by cutting it out, Buteyko would later say, but you can't avoid hypertension. The best he could do for his patients and for himself was to try to numb the symptoms. As the story goes, one night in October, Buteyko was standing alone in a hospital room, looking out from a window into a black autumn sky. He turned his focus on the reflection in the glass, a gaunt and haggard face drawing heavy breaths through an open mouth. His eyes roamed down to the white robe covering his chest, to his shoulders flexing and lifting with each labored inhale and exhale. This was the same respiratory rate he'd seen in terminally ill patients. Buteyko wasn't exercising, and yet he was breathing as if he'd just finished a workout. He tried an experiment. He started breathing less, to relax his chest and stomach and sip air through his nose. A few minutes later, the throbbing pain in his head and heart disappeared. Buteyko returned to the heavy breathing he'd been doing minutes earlier. Within 5 inhales, all that pain returned. What if overbreathing wasn't the result of hypertension and headaches, but the cause, Buteyko wondered? Heart disease, ulcers, chronic inflammation, all of them were linked to disturbances in circulation and blood pH. How we breathe affects those things. Breathing just 20% or even 10% more than the body's needs could overwork our systems. Eventually, they'd falter. Was breathing too much making people sick and keeping them that way? Buteyko took a walk. In the asthma ward, he found a man stooped over, fighting suffocation, gasping for air. Buteyko approached and showed him the technique he'd just been using. After a few minutes, the patient calmed. He inhaled a careful and clear breath through his nose and then exhaled. Suddenly, his face was flushed with color. The asthma attack was over. Back in Golden Gate Park, Olson and I are jogging deeper into the foot trail. The bucolic scene of dappled sunlight and avatar trees has morphed into a more urban mess of shopping carts and suspicious mounds of toilet paper. We realize the path less traveled may be less traveled for a reason. A quick left, and we're on our way back to the coastal route. We jog past an old hippie sitting on a tree stump playing the Jeopardy theme song on a trumpet with one hand and reading a dog-eared paperback with the other. In front of him, an impeccably dressed man goads an old dog into a beat-up Mercedes, and a woman with waist-length dreadlocks and Mork from Ork suspenders whizzes by on an electric scooter. It's a quintessentially San Francisco scene, and Olson and I fit right in. We've been practicing an extreme version of the techniques Buteyko used in the asthma ward, limiting our inhales while extending exhales far past the point of what feels comfortable or even safe. We're sweating and we're red-faced, and I can feel the veins bulging in my neck. I'm not exactly out of breath, but I don't feel satisfied either. Even when I sip a little more air, I feel like I'm being mildly strangled. The point of this exercise isn't to inflict pain. It's to get the body comfortable with higher levels of carbon dioxide so that we'll unconsciously breathe less during our resting hours, so that we'll release more oxygen, increase our endurance, and better support all the functions of our bodies. Try to extend the exhales even more, Olson says as he takes a tiny nip of air through his nose. Breathe out twice as long for each exhale, 3 times, he chides me. For a moment, I feel like I'm going to puke. Yes, he says, even slower, even less. By the late 1950s, Buteyko left the Moscow hospitals and headed to Akadem Gorodok, a research facility located in central Siberia. The distant location was by design. For the past few years, the Soviet government had sent tens of thousands of the finest space engineers, physicists, and others to live in secrecy among the laboratories. Their job was to develop cutting-edge technologies aimed at ensuring dominance. In many ways, it was a Soviet Silicon Valley, but without the fleece vests, without the kombucha, the sunshine, Teslas, and civil liberties. Buteyko had moved there at the request of the USSR Academy of Medical Sciences, the equivalent of the CDC. After his epiphany in the asthma ward, he'd pored over research papers and analyzed hundreds of patients. He'd become convinced that breathing too much was the culprit behind several chronic diseases. Like Bohr and Henderson before him, Buteyko was fascinated with carbon dioxide. He too believed that increasing this gas by breathing less could not only keep us fit and healthy, it could heal us as well. At Akadem Gorodok, he set out to conduct the most exhaustive breathing experiments that science had ever attempted. He collected a staff of more than 200 researchers in a sweeping city hospital. Subjects would come in and lie on a gurney sandwiched between stacks of machines. Phlebotomists would plug catheters into their veins while other researchers stuck hoses into their throats and electrodes around their heart and head. As the subjects breathed in and out, a primitive computer recorded 100,000 bits of data per hour. The sick and healthy, the young and old, more than 1,000 of them came to Buteyko's lab. Those patients with asthma or hypertension and other ailments consistently breathed the same, too much. They'd inhale and exhale through the mouth, packing in 15 liters or more of air per minute. The readouts showed that they had plenty of oxygen in their blood, but much less carbon dioxide. Resting heart rates were up to 90 beats per minute. Meanwhile, the healthiest patients breathed alike too. Less. They'd inhale and exhale about 10 times a minute, taking in a total of about 5 to 6 liters of air. Their resting pulses ranged from around 48 to 55, and they had about 50% more carbon dioxide in their exhaled breath. Buteyko developed a protocol based on the breathing habits of these healthy patients, which he later called voluntary elimination of deep breathing. The techniques were many and they varied, but the purpose of each was to train patients to always breathe as closely as possible to their metabolic needs, which almost always meant taking in less air. How many breaths we took per minute, that was less important to Buteyko, as long as we were breathing no more than about 6 liters per minute at rest. Within a few sessions of practicing these techniques, patients reported tingling and heat in their hands and toes. Their heart rates would slow and stabilize. The hypertension and migraines that had debilitated so many of them for so many years all began to disappear. Those already in good health felt even better. Athletes claimed big gains in performance. At around the same time, 1,000 miles east, in the industrial factory town of Zlin, Czechoslovakia, a gangly runner by the name of Emil Zatopek was experimenting with his own breath restriction techniques. Zatopek never wanted to become a runner. When the management at the shoe factory he was working at elected him for a local race, he tried to refuse. Zatopek told them he was unfit, that he had no interest, and that he never run in a competition. But he ran anyway and came in second out of 100 contestants. Zatopek saw a brighter future for himself in running, began to take the sport more seriously. 4 years later, he broke 3 national records. He developed his own training methods to give himself an edge. He'd run as fast as he could while holding his breath, take a few huffs and puffs, then do it all over again. It was an extreme version of Buteyko's methods, but Zatopek didn't call it voluntary elimination of deep breathing. Nobody did. It would be called hypoventilation training. Hypo, which comes from the Greek for under, as in hypodermic needle, is the opposite of hyper, meaning over. The concept of hypoventilation was to breathe less. Over the years, Zatopek's approach was widely derided and mocked, but he ignored everybody. The 1952 Olympics, he won gold in the 5,000 and 10,000 meters. On the heels of his success, he decided to compete in the marathon, an event he had never trained for or run in his life. He won gold. Zatopek would claim 18 world records, 4 Olympic golds, and a silver over his career. He would later be named the greatest runner of all time by Runner's World magazine. "He does everything wrong but win," said Larry Snyder, a track coach at the time. Hypoventilation training didn't exactly take off after those Olympics. Zatopek's anguished face, his teeth grinding and eyes wincing like a Matthias Grunewald Jesus, became his trademark look as he crossed the finish line, often in first place. It all seemed miserable because it was. Most athletes steered clear. Then, decades later, in the 1970s, a hard-ass U.S. swim coach named James Councilman rediscovered it. Councilman was notorious for his pain-based training techniques. Hypoventilation fit right in. Usually, competitive swimmers take about 2 or 3 strokes before they flip their heads to the side and inhale. Councilman trained his team to hold their breath for as many as 9 strokes. He believed that, over time, the swimmers could utilize oxygen more efficiently and swim faster. In a sense, it was Buteyko's breathing, but underwater. Councilman used these techniques to train the U.S. men's swimming team for the Montreal Olympics. They won 13 gold medals, 14 silver, and 7 bronze, and they set world records in 11 events. It was the greatest performance by a swim team in history. Hypoventilation training fell back into obscurity after several studies in the 80s argued it had little or no impact on performance and endurance. Whatever these athletes were gaining, researchers reported, must have been a strong placebo effect. Then, in the early 2000s, Dr. Xavier Warrens, a French physiologist, found a flaw in these studies. The scientists critical of the technique had measured it all wrong. They'd been looking at athletes holding their breath with full lungs, and all that extra air in the lungs made it difficult for them to enter a deep state of hypoventilation. Warrens repeated the test, but this time subjects practiced with a half-full technique, which is how Buteyko trained his patients, and likely how Councilman trained his swimmers. Breathing less offered huge benefits. Reports showed that hypoventilation provided a huge boost in red blood cells, allowing athletes to carry more oxygen and produce more energy with each breath. It was essentially high-altitude training, but it could be used anywhere. Over the years, the style of breath restriction has been given many names: hypoventilation, hypoxic therapy, Buteyko technique, and the pointlessly technical normobaric hypoxia training. The outcomes were the same, a profound boost in performance, and it wasn't just for elite athletes either. A few weeks of training this way increased endurance, reduced fat, improved cardiovascular function, boosted muscle mass, and more compared to normal breathing exercise. The list goes on and on. The takeaway is that hypoventilation works. It trains the body to do more with less, but that doesn't mean it's pleasant. Olson and I emerged from the shady tranquility of Golden Gate Park, stopping to face the wind-ripped Pacific Ocean. We've just jogged a few miles, inhaling fast and exhaling very long breaths to a count of 7 or more. We're trying to keep our lungs roughly half full. I want to believe that this training will be helping me, just as it helped Zatopek, Councilman swimmers, Warren's runners, and everybody else. But the past several minutes have been a challenge. The key is to find a rhythm that works for you, Olson keeps saying. The rhythm is definitely not working. I return to my more manageable practice, inhaling for 2 steps and exhaling for 5. This isn't exactly comfortable, but it's tolerable. We run across the cracked asphalt of a beachside parking lot, passing a few rusting Winnebagos and hopping over smashed cans of malt liquor. Then we head back across the highway. 20 minutes later, we're in the quietude of the park, treading a dirt path beneath an understory of trees. That's when it hits me, an intense heat at the back of my neck and pixelated vision. I'm still jogging, exhaling long breaths, but it feels as though I'm simultaneously jumping headfirst in a warm liquid. It feels great. I run a little harder, breathe a little less, feel a little more heat. It's heavy, like hot syrup seeping down into my fingertips and toes. It moves higher through my face and wraps around the crown of my head. This must be the good headache Olson keeps talking about. Of all the carbon dioxide increasing and oxygen dislodging into my hungry cells, of all those vessels in my brain and body becoming so engorged with blood that they're sending dull pain signals to my nervous system. Just when it feels like I'm about to reach some kind of existential crescendo, the little foot trail widens. The bored buffalo appear rustling behind a chain-link fence. 12 yards away is the lot at the Golden Gate Casting Club. My car is beside it, and we're done. There are no huge life epiphanies as we drive home. I can't say I'm feeling euphoric, but that's okay. My little jog proved there's much to gain from this less approach. At the same time, such extreme training would be useful only for those willing to endure so many hours of red-faced and sweaty suffering. Healthy breathing shouldn't be so much work. Buteyko knew this, and he rarely, if ever, prescribed such brutal methods. After all, he wasn't interested in coaching elite athletes to win gold medals. He wanted to save lives. He wanted to teach techniques that could be practiced by everyone, regardless of their state of health, age, or level of fitness. Over his career, Buteyko would be censured by medical critics. He'd be physically attacked and at one point have his laboratory torn up. But he pressed on. By the 80s, he had published more than 50 scientific papers, and the Soviet Ministry of Health had recognized his techniques as effective. Some 200,000 people in Russia alone had learned his methods. Buteyko allegedly was once invited to England to meet with Prince Charles, who was suffering from allergies. Buteyko helped the prince, and he helped heal upwards of 80% of his other patients suffering from hypertension and arthritis and other ailments. Breathing less, he found, was especially effective in treating respiratory diseases. It seemed to work like a miracle for asthma. In the decades since Buteyko first started training patients, asthma has become a global epidemic. Nearly 25 million Americans now suffer from it. That's about 8% of the total population, and a four-fold increase from the 80s. It is the leading cause of emergency room visits, hospitalizations, and missed school days for children. It's considered a controllable but incurable disease. Asthma is an immune system sensitivity that provokes constriction and spasms in the airways. Pollutants, dust, cold air, and more can all lead to attacks. But asthma can also be brought on by overbreathing, which is why it's so common during physical exertion, a condition called exercise-induced asthma that affects around 15% of the population and up to 40% of athletes. At rest or during exercise, asthmatics as a whole tend to breathe more, sometimes much more than those without it. Once an attack starts, things go from bad to worse. Air gets trapped in the lungs, which makes it harder to push breath in and out. More breathing, but more constriction, more panic, and more stress. The worldwide market for asthma therapies is $20 billion, and drugs often work so well that they can feel like a virtual cure. But drugs can have horrendous side effects after several years, including deteriorating lung function, more asthma symptoms, blindness, and increased risk of death. Millions of asthma sufferers already know this, and they are experiencing these problems for themselves. Many of them have trained themselves to breathe less and reported dramatic improvement. For several months before the Stanford experiment, I interviewed Buteyko practitioners and collected their stories. One was David Weeb, a luthier of cellos and violins from Woodstock, New York. I'd read about him in the New York Times. Weeb had suffered from severe asthma since he was 10. He used bronchodilators up to 20 times a day, along with steroids in an effort to keep the symptoms at bay. His body became tolerant of the drugs, which meant that Weeb had to increase his dose. After decades of constant use, the steroids weakened his eyesight. If he kept taking them, Weeb would go blind. If he stopped taking them, he wouldn't be able to breathe and might die of an asthma attack. Within 3 months of learning how to breathe less, Weeb was using no more than one inhaler puff a day, and he'd cut out steroids entirely. He claimed to feel few asthma symptoms at all. For the first time in 5 decades, he was breathing easy. Even Weeb's pulmonologist was impressed, confirming that there was a marked improvement. There were others beside him, like the chief information officer at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who had suffered from the same debilitating asthma his whole life and who, like Weeb, reported few symptoms within weeks of breathing less. "I'm a new man," he wrote. Then there was a 70-year-old woman I'd spent an hour with at a Whole Foods cafe. She'd experienced crippling asthma for the past 6 decades and could hardly walk a block without having an attack. After a few months of breathing less, she was hiking mountains and on her way to travel to Mexico. "This is nothing short of a miracle," she told me. There was a mom from Kentucky who endured such horrendous breathing problems that she contemplated suicide. Then there were athletes like Olympians Ramon Anderson, Matthew Dunn, and Sanya Richards Ross, who all used breathing less methods. They claimed to have gained a boost in performance and blunted the symptoms of respiratory problems simply by decreasing the volume of air in their lungs. The most convincing scientific validation of breathing less that I could find came by way of Dr. Alicia Murette, director of the Anxiety and Depression Research Center at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. In 2014, Murette and a team of researchers gathered more than 100 asthma sufferers, measured their lung functions and blood gases, then gave them a handheld capnometer, which tracked the carbon dioxide in their exhaled breath. Over 4 weeks, the asthmatics would carry the device around and practice breathing less to keep their CO2 levels at a healthy level of around 5.5%. If the levels dipped, the patients would breathe less until the CO2 rose back up. A month later, 80% of the asthmatics had raised their carbon dioxide and experienced significantly fewer asthma attacks. They also experienced better lung function and a widening of their airways. They breathed better. The symptoms of their asthma were markedly decreased. When people hyperventilate, there's something very strange happening, Murette wrote. In essence, they are taking in too much air, but the sensation that they get is shortness of breath, choking, air hunger, as if they're not getting enough air. It's almost like a biological system error. Willing the body to breathe less appeared to correct that error. By the end of his career and the end of his life in 2003 at the age of 80, Buteyko would become a bit of a mystic. He barely slept and claimed that his techniques could not only heal illness but promote intuition and other forms of extrasensory perception. He was convinced that heart problems, hemorrhoids, gout, cancer, and more than 100 other diseases were all caused by CO2 deficiency brought on by overbreathing. He even considered asthma attacks less a problem and more a compensatory action. The airway closing, the wheezing, the shortness of breath was the body's natural reflex to breathe less and more slowly. For these reasons and others, Buteyko and his methods have been largely dismissed by today's medical community. Nonetheless, a few dozen researchers over the past decades have attempted to gain some kind of real scientific validation on the restorative effects of breathing less. One study at the Mater Hospital in Brisbane, Australia, found that when asthmatic adults decreased their air intake by a third, symptoms of breathlessness reduced by 70% and the need for reliever medication decreased by around 90%. A half dozen other clinical trials showed the same results. Meanwhile, the Papworth method, a breathing less technique developed in an English hospital in the 60s, was shown to cut asthma symptoms by a third. But still, nobody seems to know exactly why breathing less has been so effective in treating asthma and other respiratory conditions. Nobody knows exactly how it works. There are several theories. It is a deficiency in the body that causes symptoms, said Dr. Ira Packman, an internist and former medical expert for the Pennsylvania Insurance Department. Years ago, Packman overcame his own debilitating asthma by breathing less. Replace the deficient element, Packman told me, and the patient gets better. Packman explained that overbreathing can have other deeper effects on the body beyond just lung function and constricted airways. When we breathe too much, we expel too much CO2, and our blood pH rises to become more alkaline. When we breathe slower and hold in more CO2, pH lowers, and blood becomes more acidic. Almost all cellular functions in the body take place at a blood pH of 7.4, our sweet spot between alkaline and acid. When we stray from that, the body will do whatever it can to get us back there. The kidneys, for instance, will respond to overbreathing by buffering, a process in which an alkaline compound called bicarbonate is released into the urine. With less bicarbonate in the blood, the pH lowers back to normal, even if we continue to huff and puff. It's as if nothing ever happened. The problem with buffering is that it's meant as a temporary fix. Weeks, months, or years of overbreathing, and this buffering will deplete the body of essential minerals. This occurs because as bicarbonate leaves us, it takes magnesium, phosphorus, and more with it. Without healthy stores of these minerals, nothing works right. Nerves malfunction, smooth muscles spasm, and cells can't efficiently create energy. Breathing becomes even more difficult. This is one reason why asthmatics and other people with chronic respiratory problems are prescribed supplements like magnesium to stave off further attacks. Constant buffering also weakens the bones, which try to compensate by dissolving their own mineral stores back into the bloodstream. Yes, it's possible to overbreathe yourself into osteoporosis and increased risk of bone fractures. This unending grind of imbalances and compensations, of deficiencies and strain, will eventually break the body down. Pacman was quick to point out that not all respiratory illness sufferers and other sick people have a carbon dioxide deficiency problem. Those with emphysema, for instance, may have dangerously high levels of CO2 because they've got too much stale air trapped inside. Others may test with completely normal blood gas and pH levels. But such nitpicking, he told me, missed the larger point. All these people have a breathing problem. They're stressed, they're inflamed, they're congested, and they struggle to get air in and out of their lungs. And it's these breathing problems that slow-paced, less techniques are so effective at fixing. Over several months, I visited with several Buteyko teachers and other slow-breathing devotees. They all told me the same story, of how they'd been plagued by some chronic respiratory illness that no drug or surgery or anything else could fix, how they all cured themselves with nothing more than breathing less. The techniques they use varied, but all circled around the same premise, to extend the length of time between inhalations and exhalations. The less one breathes, the more one absorbs the warming touch of respiratory efficiency, and the further the body can go. This shouldn't come as much of a surprise. Nature functions in orders of magnitude. Mammals with the lowest resting heart rates live the longest, and it's no coincidence that these are consistently the same mammals that breathe the slowest. The only way to retain a slow resting heart rate is with slow breaths. This is as true for baboons and bison as it is for blue whales and us. The yogi's life is not measured by the number of his days, but the number of his breaths, wrote B.K.S. Iyengar, an Indian yoga teacher who had spent years in bed as a sickly child until he breathed himself back to health. He died in 2014 at the age of 95. I'd hear this repeated over and over again by Olson during our Skype chats and again throughout the Stanford experiment. I'd read about it in Stow's research. Buteyko and the Catholics, the Buddhists, the Hindus, and the 9/11 survivors were onto it as well. By various means, in various ways, in various eras of human history, all these pulmonauts discovered the same thing. They learned that the optimum amount of air we should take in at rest per minute is 5.5 liters. The optimum breathing rate is about 5.5 breaths per minute. That's 5.5 inhales and 5.5 exhales. This is the perfect breath. Asthmatics, emphysemics, Olympians, and almost anyone else anywhere can benefit from breathing this way for only a few minutes a day, but much longer if possible. To inhale and exhale in a way that feeds our bodies just the right amount of air at just the right time to perform at peak capacity. To just keep breathing less.